Welcome to A Fork in Time, the alternate history podcast.
The episode of A Fork in Time that you're about to hear is courtesy of Chris Coppola and Eric Bond. I hope that you're going to enjoy it. One of the things I just wanted to let you know here is that you'll have the opportunity, if you are a patron, become a patron by going to our Patreon link, to hear what we call the pregame before an episode. Chris and Eric had the recording running while they were doing the work before they started recording. So you've always wondered what it looks like, how the sausage gets made. One of the things that we'll be releasing for our patrons over on our Patreon page is that recording of the pregame. You may find it actually more interesting than the episode itself when it's all said and done. Just wanted to make you aware of that in case that's something that might interest you. Without further ado, here's their episode.
Welcome back to A Fork in Time, everybody. This is Chris Coppola, and I am joined by Eric Bond. You want to say hello to the nice folks, Eric?
Hello, nice folks.
I know when Don hears this, he's going to laugh about me turning it around on somebody else. So, Eric, do you want to go ahead and describe the idea for today's main fork?
I would love to, Chris. So, everybody listening at home, have you ever gone on a really, bad vacation? You thought, I'm going to see this exotic land. It's going to be wonderful. Such a similar thing happened to myself one time. I was in London, and I was going on to a connecting flight to Dublin, Ireland, and the train stopped, and the conductor got off, and I'm a good half hour away from my check-in time, so everything's running well. Then 10 minutes passed. No, the conductor hasn't come back. 15 minutes passed, still not there. 25 minutes passed, and then we get the alert saying, I'm sorry, the conductor is vomiting right now. A new conductor has been assigned, and you will be on your way back to Heathrow. So my father and I ended up checking in 1 minute late for our flight, and we ended up having to spend 17 hours trying to get a hold of our travel agency, which hadn't really booked our trip. They used a different agency, which only communicated through email. Now, eventually, we were able to continue on our flight to Dublin, and you might say, that's a really bad trip. Well, it's not as bad as the trip Tsarevich, in this case, Nicholas had during his journey to Japan in 1891. By that, I mean...
Primarily because you still spoke the language, right?
Oh, absolutely.
At least this happens in a place where you can somewhat understand the subway instructions. I understand, as a regular subway rider myself, which, by the way, you guys should definitely... Well, yeah. Go ahead.
Anyway, on May 11th of 1891, on a state trip to Japan, he was attacked by a policeman with a saber. Now, no one quite knows why the policeman attacked him, but he said he thought Nicholas was a spy.
Going for a gun?
A
spy. He thought Nicholas was a spy. He thought that the devious Russian, I guess, predecessor of the KGB thought the perfect person to go to Japan and discover their secrets was their future head of state. That nobody would suspect was a Russian spy. Okay, that's where we're coming from.
Yes, so Japanese policeman Suda Sanzo, in this case, will have assassinated Tsar Nicholas, would have been Tsar Nicholas II, but in this case, Tsarevich Nicholas dies in Japan.
So, okay, Tsarevich Nicholas dies in Japan this is 1891, correct?
7 days before his birthday.
So, I just want to go ahead and put this out there. I thought about this, actually really reminded me of the first episode I ever did on A Fork in Time, where we wound up killing off Wilhelm II. And the reason I'm talking about that is this is a really important period where you have these people that aren't quite important yet, but they're about to become really important. And shout out to Alexis. I know you're going to listen to this. And at some point, we're going to do an episode. We're going for the hat trick. We're going to kill off George V and figure out what that does. We're going to all the cousins, just knock them all out. Going to figure out what that does at some point. Why is Nicholas II so important? What does he lead to, at least in the Russian time frame? In about, 3 years later, he becomes Tsar, correct?
That is correct. His father, Tsar Alexander III, dies from kidney nephritis, so kidney failure.
Okay. He's now the Tsar. I do really want to compare him to Wilhelm because he might be just as the not person you want to have this job right now, but for kind of a different way, right? Like Wilhelm is he's unhinged. I'm going to go ahead and say that. Nicholas, He's a nice guy.
He's a sweet boy. He's not so bright, but he's nice.
He's a very, devoted family man. You just don't want this man being described as an autocrat of all the Russias. So he takes over in our timeline. We're still in our, real history. 1894, he takes over. He marries a German princess who he is very devoted to. And going forward, there's the war of 1904-1905, the Russo-Japanese War, where he loses. Like, Russia loses. Like, I want to say there were, two hits, Japan hitting Russia, Russia hitting the floor. Go ahead and add kind of three hits, Japan hitting Port Arthur, Japan hitting Russia again at Tsushima Straits, then Russia hit the floor. But that's kind of like what happened. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, you are being far more diplomatic about it than I would be. But you read my character notes beforehand of how I would describe people as a little catty.
So in the process of this losing this war, there's also revolution in Russia itself, in St. Petersburg. There's protest against bread shortages, troops fire against these protesters, and to prevent a full-blown revolution breaking out, the Tsar Nicholas basically institutes some political reforms that are meant to, in effect, buy off reformists. And they get the structure, but not the form, or the structure, but not the substance of reforms. Where we're going to have a Duma, I'm still able to send it out whenever I want. I'm still able to just call it and abolish it whenever I want. It's a debating society. It can provide me show notes. I don't have to listen to these show notes. I can still do whatever I want. And not really effective democratic structures. The thing that comes to mind about Nicholas that he does a lot is he's kind of like that boss that you rush to get to, because if you're the first person to come to him with something, he's going to agree with you. So he agrees to have democracy. And then somebody else got to him with another memo. And he's like, oh, no, we're going to go back to autocracy. And he doesn't really have, you know, to think about the Wilhelm thing. Wilhelm was emotionally unstable. He did swing back and forth, but he went away and he was going that way. Nicholas is just counting the hours till five so he can go home and play with his kids. Is that a fair assessment of his management style?
I would argue Nicholas II is an autocrat like his father, but not as competent and not as intelligent.
His father, you know, whatever else you want to say, he put in the work to be an autocrat.
Yeah, he was a ruthless dude, but you know, he could see at least people who were meritorious and put them into positions like Sergei Vita. But with Nicholas, the main thing he wants you to do is say, I'm doing a good job. Tell me that I'm ordained by God to be in this job. And don't make fun of my wife because she doesn't like people.
Do not argue with her. Do not look askance at her. A lot of people think she's kind of the power behind the throne. And that becomes very important. Basically, to sum up Alexander III, say what you will about Russian autocracy. At least it's an ethos. At least he had a work ethic. There's something driving this.
Whereas Nicholas always struck me as whenever somebody wanted him to change, he would just cross his arms and say, no, 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 no. No, I'd rather die. No.
So his wife is Alexandra, correct?
That is correct. She is his cousin from England. Not from England. One second.
No. That's going to come back. That's the fourth. That's the other guy.
Oh, she's German. That's right.
Yes. Yes, she is German. And why is that important for what's about to happen?
World War I.
So in our history, Nicholas loved his wife very much. She's German. There are actually very interesting. If you look at like Russian, like, names, you see a lot of noble, you see a lot of like German names. Their name for the palace is Peter's house. The city they live in is St. Petersburg. That's a German name for it. So one of the interesting things when World War I happens is like, you thought America went through and did like victory cabbage and everything? No. Russia goes through and renames has to rename a lot of stuff. So World War I happens. They're at war with Germany. Now you've got somebody who's listening to his German wife.
As much as they say, like, oh, she's the secret power behind the throne, I think it was more the fact of they couldn't imagine anybody was this bad at a job.
It's like bad. It's one of those. It reminds me a little bit of the decision the Allies made towards the end of World War II to stop trying to assassinate Hitler, because they're like, he's doing a good job for us. Like, if we were honestly to put an agent in there, would they really be doing anything different? And so people looking at what happens in Russia during the First World War are like, oh, she's got to be there. There has to be this cabal of Germans working to sabotage us because nothing's working.
Yeah. They thought, oh, she's so cold, she's so remote. She just had social anxiety and didn't know anyone.
She's cold, she's remote. I mean, I already said she was.
Yeah.
I think that kind of goes with.
Oh. Oh. You're not making my Omi Veep. Come on.
So Yeah, they just kind of, you know, crap the bed on the whole leading Russian World War One thing, are overthrown in the February Revolution of 1917. Things kind of don't coalesce until the Bolsheviks come in the October Revolution of November 1917.
Yeah. Just ahead of time, we are going to be using the standard calendar dates. We are not going to be trying to refer back and forth with the calendar they used at the time, because that would be a headache.
And Soviet Union starts, boom, we're all familiar with that. So that's a pretty big sweep, but let's take it back to where the fork is. So our fork is that basically this Japanese police officer is a better, I want to say a better shot, but he was using a sword, a better swordsman, actually finishes off Nicholas. Go ahead.
Basically, Nicholas's cousin George of Greece is unable to parry the second blow of the Japanese man's sword. So Suda Sanzo does assassinate Nicholas by essentially cleaving his head with a sword.
Cool. What happens from here? What because Nicholas dies here, what starts changing?
So the main thing that starts changing, and in our own timeline, Suda was sentenced to prison. They tried pushing for the death penalty because they thought, well, he tried to assassinate a monarch, and that's on par with our monarch, so we should treat it like he would have killed our emperor. It didn't stick. He got life imprisonment, but died a few months later anyway of pneumonia before being exiled.
I find it really interesting that he died of pneumonia, only because, and if you guys would like to hear our off podcast discussions, you can go ahead and become Patreon subscribers, because in our previous discussion, I kind of drew a parallel between what happened with this incident and what happened in Sarajevo in 1914. And funny thing, the one guy that kind of started World War One also died of pneumonia in prison.
Oh, I didn't even know that he died of that. Okay.
Yes. The Austrians kept him in prison and he died of pneumonia in prison.
At least he got a good sandwich in.
Yeah.
Anywho, so at this point, the Tsarevich title, so kind of like the Prince of Wales of England, next in line to the throne, heir apparent, would have fallen to his brother George, not the George who saved his life in our own timeline. That's George of Greece. This is
not the George that I'm going to kill off in another future episode with Alexis, but
so many bloody Georges. Anyway, so Grand Duke George Romanov, he would have been the next in line for the throne. The problem is that this is the same year he has contracted tuberculosis. And in fact, he was on this trip, but had to be sent back to Greece for treatment because of his worsening condition. In our own timeline, he dies in 1898 while having a fit while on a motorcycle.
So basically, with the death of Nicholas, nothing necessarily happens, because even at this point, Nicholas is still the Tsarevich. He is still the person waiting in the wings. The problem with people waiting in the wings is they got this nasty habit of becoming the people in charge. And 3 years later, in 1894, as we talked about their father, Alexander III, you know, say what you will, at least it's a work ethic, passes away. And now we're in a situation where we have a tubercular almost like a germ bomb on the throne of Russia, right?
Yeah, and at this time, he was living in one of their summer homes, essentially, just trying to recuperate and couldn't come back in time for his father's funeral. So, and he pretty much stayed that way until his own death in 1898. So now we have this question, does George become the new czar, or does he abdicate in favor of his even younger brother, Michael? And Michael is age 16 at this time.
And before anybody is like, we did the math on this. We really did do the math on this. Peter the Great took over as when Peter came in, he was a 10-year-old. They appointed a regent who lasted until he was 17, at which point the regent stepped away, conveniently stepped away. So literally, Peter the Great, when you're somebody the great, you know, you did something good, came in at about the same age. So we think, even though he's young, Michael would have become czar himself, correct?
Correct. Maybe a brief regency in his mother, but more than likely he becomes czar in his own right. Very quickly. So,
while we're in a situation where Nicholas is almost a non-entity and Russia is just kind of stumbling one thing to the next, tell us a little bit about Michael. Does Michael come in and take up the scepter, and what does he do with it?
So Michael was the favorite child of his parents. He was typically seen as being the most imaginative of his siblings. He was a bit of a rule breaker, but he was so far down the line, everybody kind of treated it with like an indulgence of like, yeah, he's a good kid. He was actually the closest with his father because he could treat him kind of informally and have more of a normal relationship. Whereas Alexander III seemed to almost just kind of be burdened by having Nicholas. We're going to compare him to Nicholas a lot because, well, it's kind of like doing an episode of the show. It's very easy to think of timelines with absolute monarchs as opposed to democracies because there are just so many people you have to keep track of. But anywho, Michael is seen as this rule breaker, kind of a playboy, and genuinely intelligent, where Nicholas might have been more reactionary, cautious, and conservative. Michael was kind of the liberal man out of his immediate family. His mom was kind of a moderate, being from more Western Europe, but he was the one of like advocating for a democracy with universal suffrage when he was made the czar for a day in our own timeline. So we have him. He has fallen in love with his cousin who shares, their dads are brothers. Her name is Princess Beatrice. And he decides he wants to get married. In our own timeline, they did not because the Orthodox Church has a rule against consanguous marriage? Is that the phrase?
It's consanguination. Yeah, consanguous, yes.
Yeah. Of where they are first cousins, and so that cannot be allowed. Fun fact, I am actually doing a play right now where one of the plot points is my character is awaiting a dispensation from the Catholic Church to marry his first cousin. Playboy of the Western world. It's fun. Anyway, what we have been working out in this timeline is that Michael, who married a commoner in our own timeline, later on and used Alexei's hemophilia scare at their hunting lodge when everyone thought he was going to die. I think it was 1910 in our timeline. He used that to get his wife and his son legitimized and to be accepted back. So we could definitely see him taking advantage of, okay, well, there's no one really else with a direct line to the prior czar. either let me get married or I'm just going to abdicate and let you all figure it out.
By the way, other fun thing, when you start looking at the marriage that Michael actually made, it's kind of hard not to hear echoes of Edward VII. She's currently encumbered. Is that how one would say it? She's married to her second husband already, who's a cavalry officer in Michael's regiment. So, yeah, there's a lot of crossover here.
Yeah, but hopefully less fond of Hitler is what we're hoping for with Michael.
Oh, yeah, no. Definitely the liberal one. Definitely not, you know, and I think I've mentioned this before, right? Like, I'm watching The Crown, and, you know, I know Edward VII, and the whole time they're talking about Edward VII, I'm sitting there shouting at the screen, he's a Nazi. They use lighting, they use music, they use all of those wonderful tricks that I'm sure you're more familiar with being involved in productions to let you know that Edward is the bad guy. And like, I think it's the beginning of season. It's either the end of one or two when they finally come out and let you know he's a Nazi. And I'm like, they have pictures of the man with Hitler. Just show that at the beginning and we can skip all of this exposition.
Yeah, there's a whole, just a brief side tangent. Even after World War II, Edward was still saying, like, well, you know, it was those Americans really pushing for the war. Well, them and the Jews. But let's get back to our good pal Mikey here.
Yes. So he is trying to talk, kind of also reminiscent of the last episode. I guess it's the last episode we did. I have to admit, I was horrible about our timeline of recording episodes versus when these would come out. But the last episode we did about the death of Henry VIII, you won't let me marry who I'm doing. That's fine. And also the Russian Orthodox Church is a little more tied to the Tsar than the Catholic Church is to the King of England. So they're a little more responsive to some pushback from an assertive Tsar.
Yeah, there's a specific word even like, patriarch over czar over patriarch, something like that, that goes to that phrase. So we're assuming he's able to get married to Beatrice. And at this point, he's probably already saying, like, we need an elected parliament. He's a known Anglophile.
In every sense of that word.
Compared to the Russophile Nicholas and Alexander, to where we say he probably builds on something like the Zenspa or something even like when Wilhelm called for the Prussian nobles to be assembled for a appointed Duma that would serve 5 years and then move towards a constitution. So we got this going on roughly in 1895 to 1900.
This is the appointed, almost the Constituent Constitutional Assembly, while we're going to have some Zenfo representatives helping advise and ease Russia into democracy, into some form of democracy. And also, this is something else that I'm, you know, making a point to mention. In our timeline, Michael took somebody from the royal family and developed industrial enterprises and became basically financially independent. He's not one of those royals running around collecting a check, doing appearances. He's running economic enterprises. So the idea here is you basically got, he comes in and does almost a Gorbachev thing of, we need to economically open up, let's give Victor a blank check. Let's really start developing industry. And we also need to open up politically. And we try and do it at the same time. Is that kind of a fair, what we think is going to be happening during this kind of, this first period of, you know, he takes over 94, he gets his feet under himself. 95, he convenes the first appointed parliament. they're advising and helping while we're developing the Constitution, and we're still really ramping up industrial development.
Right. Yeah. Probably having the finance minister, Sergei Vita, as his first prime minister, which he did assume in our timeline. And this would probably suit Vita better to have someone like Michael, who's more interested in being a constitutional monarch as opposed to Nicholas.
That could be said of any single prime minister ever who ever worked with a monarch.
Yeah. That is a very good point. Meanwhile, in Japan at this point is, they are trying to get from out from under the unequal treaties forced on them. We typically think of the unequal treaties as applying mostly to China and the multiple spheres of European influence there, but it also did apply to Japan, largely from the United States, since they kind of forced the Japanese to open up at gunpoint. But
No, kind of.
Japan has
for
been
a great documentary on this. Watch The Last Samurai.
Oh, God. Extra History actually has a great series about the end of the daimyo and the ascension of the Meiji period. So I'll maybe include a link of that here. But
over The Last Samurai, that's a better source than...
Yes, where Tom Cruise, an American, is playing a Frenchman. Yeah. Whole thing. There's been a series of civil wars in Japan, but eventually the Meiji emperor, we call him Meiji now. They would have just referred to him as the emperor with a personal name of Moshito being what he would use among confidants, but we call him Meiji because that's the name of the era. So Meiji has established a parliament, a two-tier parliament, kind of similar to the Prussian model, to where it's very much based on there is an active monarch, but still an elected assembly. And what happens is that they are focusing on Pan-Asianism as a foreign policy idea of we need to get Korea and Japan and China all on the same page. Japan will be a first among equals just because we are the most technologically advanced and not holding ourselves back like the Qing did.
Isn't that interesting how whenever somebody is coming up with the first among equals, they're always referring to themselves as the first among equals?
Augustus Caesar, what are you doing here? Yeah. But so that is kind of where they're at this time. They're building up their industry. At this point, they're having to rely on a lot of commercial monopolies called the Zaibatsu system. And it's very similar to what Witte is doing in Russia, in that they are trying to expand their production capabilities. Now, as Russia is dealing with its own constitutional crisis, Japan is probably saying, well, we're ahead of them. We have a constitution. We have an emperor, and we have an army. Let's go take Korea and China. So they start the first Sino-Japanese War, which lasts from 1894 to about 1895. I want to say, let me...
That is 94-95. You are correct, sir.
94 to 95. Thank you. So at this point in our own timeline, Russia tried to interfere with the peace terms by saying, Japan, you're asking too much. Now with Russia out of the picture and the other imperial powers of Europe being really too far away to bother with it, and as long as their own personal spheres of influence are not being hampered with.
And also, just frankly, this is something we talked about.
Yeah.
China and Japan and Korea and the Taiwanese, they're all just a bunch of Asians fighting amongst themselves. This doesn't really impact us. And we Europeans still have the ability, really believe they do, to go in and impose our will at any point on whoever we want, whether we're imposing it on the Qing dynasty or the Meiji dynasty, doesn't matter. We can do whatever we want. This has nothing to do with the price of tea. Is that a fair assessment?
That is a fair assessment. So if you've seen Dune, as long as the spice flows, no one will be upset. So China now is able to establish a presence, or I'm sorry, Japan is now able to establish a presence in China and in Korea, and is able to build up their own sphere of influence, which was part of the Japanese project of modernization of, like, we're falling behind all these Western powers. If we don't want to end up like China, we need to become imperial powers in our own right.
So who did that lead them into contact conflict with? Other than, by the way, short little side note, this is leading up to something which is amazing because on a personal side note, I had a former boss who was Taiwanese and found it amazing because we're about to get to the point where two powers are fighting a war in China. And China has nothing to do with it. It's not even taught in Chinese history. It's a war that happens in China, and the people living there are just bystanders. So what am I talking about?
The Russo-Japanese War?
Yes.
It was between Boxer Rebellion and Russo-Japanese War. They both
definitely want to go back to Boxer.
I imagine the Boxers would have been taught.
The Boxers were, and the Boxers were an active participant in the Boxer Rebellion. So, but go on, talk a little bit about the Boxer Rebellion.
So the Boxer Rebellion was kind of the last gasp of the Qing trying to have influence. And essentially it was an idea that they and one of the Buddhist brotherhoods of
Righteous and Harmonious Fist, correct?
Correct. So, who everybody called the Boxers, because that also sounds cool.
It sounds kind of like something Muhammad Ali would have come up with. He really did have a way with the words.
Yes. Oh, my God. It's just so cool. But essentially, it's kind of a terrorist attack in that they are attacking foreigners at this time. And their main thought is, we are going to expel all of the foreigners, all of the missionaries out of China. And we are going to, it's kind of a race war in a sense, in that they are attacking the Europeans, but this would definitely apply to anyone who is Japanese living at this time within their borders. And this causes a major backlash from the European powers, resulting in a large alliance of Americans, British, Russian, Germans, and the Japanese get in on it too, and they crush them.
I feel like the Italians were involved. Just the Italians and the Austrians, I want to say, sent troops.
They were probably there.
Yeah. It's kind of a who's who. It's kind of like a Bob Hope, the road to the type. Let's just pick up everybody and have them come along. Anyway, yeah, he did not perform for those troops. Interestingly enough, this is one of the last wars Bob Hope did not perform for. But
before times, BH, yes. Before Hope.
Before Hope. So fast forwarding to what I was initially talking about, which is the Russo-Japanese War of 1904-5. At this point, let's go back to Russia for a second, just because in 1900, we do have the first actual elected body, correct? The first elected Duma, elected under the Constitution, drafted after Michael becomes Tsar of it, correct?
That is correct. Now, I personally would predict, like, it would probably be filled of the Octoberists, more like constitutional Democrats who are more kind of moderate, since we don't have the crackdowns that happened in our own timeline spurring them on. Okay. But as Chris and I were discussing on our special patron exclusive, undoubtedly, it's probably going to be the same way, where it's basically just a slog on both resources as Russia is trying to reassert itself in China and Korea and bringing itself into conflict with Japan.
So they're trying to modernize. They're trying to become, you know, a more power, but it hasn't taken yet. They haven't had a chance to take it, right? Is that a fair assessment?
That is definitely correct.
So even though we've got these changes going on, we think the underlying forces haven't really had a chance to effect this. And the Russo-Japanese War of 1904-5 really happens the way it did in our timeline. Is that a fair assessment?
Correct.
Yeah. Japan handily wins. In our timeline, there's a revolution in Russia. In this one, there's not, because you've kind of opened up the society and there isn't the feeling that there's no other choice. Is that right?
That is correct. So there's a feeling in the society that we're losing the war. It's all because of these liberal Democrats who are in office and in power. We didn't need all of this change. Like, what's really going on?
Right. And the war ends the way it did in our timeline. And you have now, 1905, another parliament that needs to be elected. What kind of parliament is that? What's the composition of this, of the people that come to power after this? First, is it a handover of power? Is it an election where the people in power change, or are these Octoberists able to sustain their popularity?
I would say if they hold a majority, it's the slimmest majority, because we're going to get a ton of, they're definitely going to get voted out. It's more than likely going to pass into the hands of people who would have formed the Black Hundreds in our own timeline. These are ultra czarist kind of fanatics who come into power and want to just kind of turn the clock back on this whole liberal reform.
These people, there's two things to think about them as. One would be brown shirt. They are brown shirts. They are Nazi brown shirts, period. They do everything that the Nazi brown shirts do. They have massive pogroms. They go into Jewish villages and communities and just destroy them. The other thing that comes to my mind is, interestingly enough, I don't care what RT says, there are a lot of Russian bike groups today that are ultra-Putinist, ultra-nationalistic. So maybe the Nazis are on the other side this time too. But anyway, these are the kind of people that get elected to this next parliament. Ultra pan-Slavic nationalists want to come in and roll back the political reforms. But by the way, might even be okay expanding some of the economic reforms. Is that a fair assessment? Especially when you've got people coming in saying, we're for the czar, and the czar saying to do something. They kind of do that.
Yeah, it's definitely a more of a populist movement to where it's like, yeah, we want reforms done on like land ownership and stuff like that. But we love the czar, man. The czar, it's kind of, I've had this experience where I talk to more, like, you know, my political alignment. And I talk to members of my own family who are on the opposite end. And it's like, we agree on a lot. You just don't like my labels.
I mean, that's one of the really interesting things, even in our timeline, is so much of what happened in 1904 was this belief, this honest belief amongst workers in St. Petersburg that if the czar's a good guy, we like the czar, and all we need to do is tell him what's going on because he's surrounded by these bad advisors. And if we could just get our petition to him, he'll understand and wave his magic czar wand and it'll all be fixed. So much of it, even getting into, you know, later what happened with his German wife, was this concept that the czar is still essentially good. The leader is still essentially good. The problem is advisors around him. And that makes it very easy for the czar to stay in power. And just every time, even thinking about into Soviet times, they can always just purge somebody and the great leader is still the great leader, right?
Yeah, it's very much like how Marx described Russia as being this kind of god emperor status, to where it will be impossible to do a revolution along the same lines as he was hoping would happen in Western Europe, of a bourgeoisie revolution and then a proletarian one, because it was just too interconnected with the idea of this divine monarch. So now we have a divine monarch who is very clearly does not want to be a divine monarch. And for the past 10 years has been kind of doing the policy of, I'm not a divine monarch. I'm just here to fill this job. I may have been ordained by God, but I'm just a guy.
You know, I'm the clerk's reference. I'm not even supposed to be here today.
Yeah.
So the Black Hundreds come in and start an aggressive policy. At this point, what do we think Russia's foreign policy becomes?
It probably becomes more bellicose and expansionist at this time. I still think, like we both agreed, the Japanese are going to win the war. Probably also with the help of the investment from Jacob Schiff, which we also discussed. If you ever find the podcast Dead Jews by Dana Horn, she has a great episode all about this. Jacob Schiff becomes the first American. He's born in Germany, but he moves to America and naturalizes during the Civil War. He becomes the first American to meet with the Emperor of Japan. He gets the Order of the Sacred Treasure and the Order of the Rising Sun and becomes a national celebrity and starts this whole experience that we might cover in a part two, potentially, and see how that develops. We'll talk about it. Maybe part, yeah.
The other thing we talked about is the alignment of what does the Empress Beatrice, normally, by the way, whenever you bring a foreign princess into Russia, she has to get some Russian name. So I don't know what that's going to, Viktorovna, I'm not sure.
The dude's name is Michael.
I actually would go with Mikhail just to Russify it. But what is the fact that his wife is a British princess do to the pre-World War I power structures of Europe?
Well, it would definitely tie him closer to the British royal family, to the British government. We did discuss that, Michael or Mikhail was a huge Anglophile and definitely more identified with that side of his family than the more Russophiles among them. And that he would probably want to become more entrenched with the allied powers that we see developing, like France, who at this point is pouring massive foreign capital into Russia's modernization projects.
Yeah. Also, much more palatable to these Western powers now, because these Western powers view themselves as democratic. And if you think about what, you know, American propaganda painted Germany as in World War I, they were the Hun. They were the barbarians. It's kind of hard to fight the Hun when you got like the czarist Cossacks on your side. So Russia becomes real. And this is an interesting argument that a lot of people make about American entry is like, you notice how it happens as soon as the czar is gone. Within a month, America's in. But Russia's a lot more palatable as an ally and developing towards the West in a really intentional way. So you're saying in our timeline, when the balloon goes up in 1914, there's an official alliance between France and Russia, but not with Great Britain. Great Britain doesn't even get into the war. There you have, I want to say it was Asquith, the foreign minister, when it begins, saying, we have no treaties. There is nothing to get us into this war, right up until Belgium. So, right?
Yeah. Keeping with Britain's current model of always being the maybe on your Facebook invites.
So now we're going to take away that maybe button. And they're more explicitly tied into this power system. They're very acceptable to the Franco-British powers. They are informal alliances with the Franco-British powers, and they're rebuilding. What do you think that does to... Is there a way to prevent World War I? Does this change World War I? Does it move it up? Does it push it back? How? What happened? Go. Talk. Please help me.
Well, at this time, what we are assuming is this probably is going to be like an accelerant on all of the inter-party treaties. Even if Britain does not agree to become a formal member, it still wants to keep its, tentative attachment to everybody. It would still probably be drawn in because in 1911, there is going to be a crisis over Morocco.
And go ahead.
No, you go ahead. You know more about this one than I do.
Not to get too into it. Very simply, there's German involvement, there's French involvement, and they come into a clash with each other. It just so happens that in 1911, when this actually happens, they are able to kind of defuse it. In a world where you got, the phrase I used was ossified alliances, where this is a lot more set in stone. And you've also got a Germany making the calculation that maybe we need to fight Russia now because they are really focusing on developing. They are really nationalistic. We don't want to have to fight them in 5 years and 10 years when they've had a chance to, make enough guns for all their guys. Much rather fight them when they only have guns for half of them, right?
Right. This might be a very nitpicky thing to say, but Michael might just be a better manager than Nicholas and be able to get more things effective because he's not going to be focusing on every tiny issue that crosses his desk. He's going to be focusing on a bigger picture almost always, which is one of the benefits of being a figurehead, which makes them very odd parallels to the Japanese in my mind of just like, they need to get caught back up with their rivals across Europe. They're trying to expand their railways and their production. And in a way, they're both kind of seen as being slightly less than the Japanese, much more less than their Western European counterparts.
So the war starts 3 years early. We don't need to get into the details of like how the telegrams flow, which way, which I do feel, well, almost by definition, there is no Willie and Nikki telegram. There's a Willie and there's a Willie and Mikey telegram.
Mikey being like, we were never close. Why are you texting me?
who this? And how does what happens in the war, do we think? How does this play out?
Well, I think we would still find ourselves in kind of a stalemated position along Western Europe and Eastern Europe. Definitely because of the advent of the machine guns and trench warfare, we're definitely going to see that more ingrained. The thing that's going to happen is that Russia has been able to modernize and with more effective leadership, especially one that even with the Black Hundreds gumming up the works, is still going to be more responsive as democracies typically are than autocracies, which is a very weird thing to say because we always seem to kind of say like, well, autocracies are just more efficient. Yeah, it's efficient for one person who has to know everything, as opposed to a democracy to where it's slow, but it does spread out.
The autocracy works if you have the right kind of person, but you don't want to keep rolling those dice.
Yeah. Which came Snake Eyes in our own timeline.
Right. So looking at how this works out, basically, we think that in our timeline, Russia weirdly did a lot to defeat Germany because they absorbed a lot of those blows. And the French and British almost crack as soon as Treaty of Brest-Litovsk is signed. The Germans are able to transfer all of those forces back to the West and hit them with their entire power. The British and French are struggling to get the Americans there in time to hold it together. In our timeline, in this scenario, A, Russia's just better at this. They're not mismanaging. They're actually running things based upon who the best person is rather than who. I'm a little surprised we haven't thrown out the name Rasputin yet, but let's go ahead and say that, right?
I was thinking the same thing. They also have a monarch who's not just constantly palling around with different mystics.
Yeah, right.
And so,
or if he is palling around with mystics, let's not judge his man. He's not letting them make state decisions.
Yeah. Like, it's not going to be like, oh, these are suddenly going to be the perfect people at the perfect time just because things are different now. But it would be very hard to be worse than in our own timeline with new management.
So they stay in the war to the end. And with all of these pressures, what do we think happens? Who cracks first in this scenario?
Well, we think that the Germans would eventually have to crack. What we have going on with Japan at this time is that they've crossed over into the German provinces in China.
And the German concessions. They're not taking Swabia. They're not coming into Hanover. They're taking Zingdal, which is not German at all by any stretch of anybody's imagination.
Yeah. So they're going into the German colonies, moving in, and probably would be better utilized by, especially because Japan has had more experience now because of their recent civil wars in the last 30 years. They're better equipped to know what kind of strategies and technologies are going to be utilized in a more modern conflict where everybody is still 40 years behind in the 1880s to 1870s. So Japan has this modern sense of experience, kind of like America with the First World War, and everybody got the tiniest taste from the Boxer, but not enough. So Japan would probably have to be utilized, maybe against the Ottomans, probably could be brought in on the Western Front, but we see a more engaged Japanese presence as part of this.
I think off podcast or I can't, we need to stop calling it off podcast, I guess on Patreon podcast or something like that. I think I said in our timeline, Japan is the only army that's home by Christmas. In this scenario, they're not.
Yeah.
So that pressure is kept up. Economically, Germany can only have its farmers in trenches for so long before it just can't feed itself anymore. It can't import the food it needs. And kind of what we suggested is by 1914 and the failed harvest of 1913, Germany would have to do something crazy to break out, which is exactly what they did in our timeline, order the high seas fleet to try and break the British blockade, and the high seas fleet refuses to go. That starts the entire revolution. The Kaiser has to abdicate. Now it's the Kaiser abdicating instead of a czar. And that is, I think, where we decided to kind of pause this, right? We do have some really interesting ideas about what's going to come up. I will say, you know, subscribe, become patrons, please, because we'll give you some previews of where we're going to take it from here. We've got some great ideas, a couple of different ones. Do you have anything else, Eric?
No, nothing I can say without giving it away, but I just realized Franz Ferdinand might still be alive. But I'm gonna put that into my notes.
So that's
here.
A really interesting argument, a really interesting idea. If he is still alive, that's true. He's the heir to the Austrian throne, but Franz Josef is still alive. He doesn't die even in our timeline until 1916, right?
Right. So we're going to have to save that and see what happens.
So you guys are definitely going to want to come back. I think this is one from a relatively small thing, really good idea. We've got a couple of different forks we intend to take. And speaking of that, Eric, if someone should come upon a fork in the road, what do you think they should do?
Oh, take it.
So thanks for that. Everybody stick around. We will try and come back with some more content, some more ideas about how this one thing could have really changed. Some really fun scenarios from here. Hope to see you guys soon. Bye.
Thanks for listening to A Fork in Time, the alternate history podcast. Learn more and provide feedback by visiting our website at www.aforkintimepodcast.com. Connect to us on Facebook at facebook.com/aforkintime or follow us on Twitter at AFIT Podcast. If you want to support the show financially, visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/aforkintime. We hope you will join us next time.